The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 20. The Day Before. A few hours before the sunrise, Romasanta arrived at Malfoy Manor with his precious cargo. He didn't have a wand with which to operate, and he didn't want to risk a fireplace in case they took the wearable from him as he went through the Ministry atrium. He had to walk, take a bus, walk some more, and finally get to a port key that left him just 5 miles away from the manor. In that time, the werewolf had tried to escape twice, and Romasanta had had to beat him into submission just as many times. He hadn't tried a third, probably because he was barely awake. Not many people were up at that time, but beyond the house elves, there were also a couple of wizards awake. Voldemort didn't like how the house had been unguarded in the past. There was now a permanent retinue on watch, and they were the ones who opened the doors for Romasanta. The world was only now starting to be less dark, no pink or gray yet in the sky. Hermione was awake, too, despite the time. She had less trouble than Harry and Draco with mornings, so she always took the last watch of the night. Nowadays, they got up before sunrise, so by the time the first rays hit the roofs of the houses in Diagon Alley, they would be in the street, moving to a new secure location. There is something about the sunrise that makes any suspicious activity suddenly look efficient and trustworthy. During the sunrise, it doesn't look like you are trying to avoid being watched, but you are naturally unseen. Hermione waited by the window with her needle wand in her hand, taking slow and even breaths that were perfectly measured to keep her calm but alert. The street was only now becoming deep blue. When the big letters in the storefronts became visible, she would wake the boys and they would go down the block to a lawyer's office that had been emptied 2 weeks ago. Apparently it had been found that the lawyer there was helping move money to the continent for the refugees. It had been thoroughly inspected, so it was safe to expect that it wouldn't get another visit soon. Percy was also up. He had been up all night and the night before, although he thought he might have gotten a nap at some point during the previous morning. He was busy at work with both a saw and his wand, sabotaging a bridge. A few members of the Order were supposed to cross it, when, not sure, but he knew he had to do this first and then see about the platform in Hogsmeade, that was for certain. They wouldn't be able to cross the bridge, and that would force them to go through the path down the hill. A small change, but one that would make them go near the village and come across the elderberry cousins. If Percy had it right, the elderberries would arrive at Hogwarts in time so that one could go do, what was it? He didn't remember now, but it was important that one was there early enough to help fight Rookwood, and the other would be instrumental in saving Moody's life, because he didn't take any excuses, and I feel all right, and would shove the treatment down your throat. If he resisted, there were other avenues also related to the digestive system where medicine could be introduced. Hogwarts had always had breakfast early. Nowadays there were two turns, one for the older inhabitants, teachers and refugees and all those kids that had grown so fast, and another for the younger children. It was just before the first turn that Severus made the announcement. Macmillan was dead. Philip might be. They were going to assume that the castle was in danger and classes were cancelled today. He would let them know when it was appropriate to panic, but for now they should keep calm and await instructions. His words were followed by a heavy silence broken by a loud snap when a nervous Gryffindor broke the quill she had been clutching. It might be a good sign that the biggest concern after the announcement, other than Philip, was whether or not they had to take down the decorations. Preparing the castle for battle and maybe siege was one thing, but the twins had just hung a 5-meter banner depicting Voldemort in the toilet, and getting it there had been quite a hassle. Longbottom was unexpectedly loud about it, but he probably just wanted to make a distraction so people would be free to worry without being embarrassed or feeling like all eyes were on them. The girl who had broken her quill, or a toy wand she had been fidgeting with, whatever, had turned a deep red, and she had the kind of pale skin that really showed a blush. Besides, it's not like they knew for certain that they were going to be attacked today. They had fooled them once already. Maybe they would do it again. This wasn't such a good thought as it might seem. Knowing for sure that an attack was coming was somehow preferable to this uncertainty. They were torturing the werewolf. They didn't have to. The Dark Lord had rummaged through his mind as he pleased. He had seen enough to convince him that the betrayal was true, and Snape was the most despicable traitor. He'd had the wolf on his knees, screaming in pain and doing all he could to keep him out of his mind, to keep him from learning the truth. There was no way to keep Voldemort out if he wanted inside your mind. You could hide your thoughts, make him not want to look, as no doubt Snape had been doing, but you couldn't keep him out when he was pushing in. There was no mind strong enough to withstand him. Voldemort had screamed in rage as he left the room. Narcissa wasn't sure what had happened, but in his fury he had broken all the windows and mirrors in the room, and he had torn the door off of its hinges. He was now pacing in his sitting room, calling for all the monsters and all the men that had sworn him allegiance to come forward. There was no need whatsoever to keep torturing that man. There was no need to begin torturing him even, as the Dark Lord had already gotten everything he wanted from him before the first Death Eater drew out his wand. There was no point to the torture other than to cause suffering. Nothing that the man said would make it stop. They were going to march over Hogwarts. Narcissa was sure of it. Voldemort had called for Snape and the Carrows to present themselves in the manor, but even if they did, he would march to the castle and kill everyone he found in there nonetheless. Narcissa kept thinking about that, about how they would go about it, how many people would be sent, and in which order. About the men laughing in her ballroom who would soon be fighting their way into a school to do much worse than what they were doing to the poor, broken man on the floor. The way they laughed, it was obscene. The way they tortured him when they needn't. And they were all there, all of them. Her husband, too. All except Bellatrix. She was at her lord's side, helping him organize his forces and the deployment over Hogwarts. As much as Bellatrix would like to make the wolf mad with pain, she was not there in the ballroom. She was where she was useful, doing what was best for the Dark Lord's mission. She had even refrained from requesting to kill Snape herself, and instead, when her lord told her to contact the giants, she set to it. Narcissa thought it meant something. That her sister was on business while everyone else played. It meant something that they would needlessly torture that man while there was a fire to stomp out and a betrayer to catch and kill. These were some of the most powerful wizards and witches in the country. Skilled fighters. People who knew all about the dark arts. But they were not preparing properly for the fight. They were pushing all their surprise and ire and fear, all their emotions, in the curses they were casting over that unfortunate man. Like a bacchanalia lasting too long. Many of them were still wearing their sleep clothes. Not Lucius, of course, he was properly dressed. But he hadn't shaved, and he was jumping and singing like the others. The most handsome bird ululating in the mad cage. As far as she knew, only Narcissa had taken time to bathe, dress, and have breakfast. She had taken a tray with tea to Voldemort, but neither he nor Bellatrix had touched it. She had stayed in the room with them, quiet and still, for almost half an hour. The tea was now cold, so Narcissa took the tray and left with it. She heard a particularly piercing and penetrating exclamation as she crossed the corridor. She would have thought that it was Alicia, but the woman could barely get more than a grunt nowadays. It might be Georgina Parkinson laughing with pleasure. The thing is, the man had died over an hour ago. Narcissa had been on her way to the kitchen to get the tea tray. She didn't allow house elves to touch the Dark Lord's food. And she had seen them from outside the room. Standing at the feet of the stairs, she had looked across the lobby and the place where the door used to be. And she had seen as the man writhed while they levitated him up to the ceiling. His face was bruised and covered in blood, and she had wished him dead while she clutched her wand. The next time she saw him floating up, he was dead. She knew he was dead, and he looked dead to her. But they were casting so many curses over him that Narcissa guessed it could look as if his body were still moving, when it was just the momentum of the spells. They were yelling and laughing so loud that they couldn't hear each other, so they didn't miss his screams of pain. Other than when Voldemort looked through his mind, he hadn't been a screamer to begin with. If there had been a short and faint flash of green, they certainly didn't notice it between all the curses flying around. Not even Narcissa was sure she had seen it. That had been then, when she went to get the tea. Now she left the tray with the teapot and the cups and the most delicate pastries on a console near the door. There were so many tables and consoles and corbels in the house. Each room had a love seat and a settee and a dozen little tables around them with porcelain vases and delicate boxes. Narcissa went up the stairs, past the room she shared with her husband and the room that Voldemort had claimed for himself. Past the bedroom she didn't visit and all the way up to the aviary. She had seen, and more importantly, she had listened, and now she knew what to do and what to say exactly. The higher she was when she cast the Patronus, the sooner it would get lost in the clouds. The message was brief and to the point. She didn't waste any time on sentimentalities and thank yous. It was a firm order more than a warning, followed by a short list of what was to come. It might seem like a death sentence or even like a taunt, but any Slytherin worth the name knew that information was useful even when it spoke of hopelessness. If anything, you would know not to waste your energy hoping and instead prepare for the end. Information was good, and she was sending it, and that was all she could do. She didn't know how she knew. She was no Legilimens, that was for sure. She could not have grabbed the thought as Legilimens sometimes did without even casting a spell. She was a good occluder, certainly. Just as Severus had turned out to be. Was that it, then? Had she recognized in Severus the same careful concealment that she had in herself? They had both won Voldemort's trust, and they had both betrayed it. And they had both loved the same man, or tried to love. And at some point she had looked at him, her rival, that hateful half-blood man, and she had known. She had no idea how. Even after she sent word of Bellatrix's arrival to Hogwarts, she couldn't know for sure if Snape was a traitor. She had been very careful in her wording. She didn't imply that they were in danger, merely stated what was coming. It might be that they had simply used her message to clean up the place, that it was taken as a courtesy and that Narcissa had been wrong about him. But she hadn't. And they didn't take it as a courtesy, did they? They had done more than that. They had been so clever, all the people in Hogwarts, so clever. So much so that now they might become arrogant. Voldemort was calling, and because he had managed to fool him until now, Snape would answer. He would come. He would tell some story that would explain everything perfectly, with that calm demeanor and that beautiful voice. And he would die. He would die. No lie of his would be good enough, not this time. Even here, all the way up in the tower, she could feel the hot pulse of his rage sweeping the manor. Maybe that's why everybody was acting like crazed animals. Could Legilimens do that? Drown someone in their emotions? It might have been when the mudblood escaped. Yes, that was it. That's when Narcissa knew. Severus had come that morning because Lucius had called for him, and when Lucius called, no one refused him. No one refused Voldemort either. But it was a different sort of call altogether. At least it was now that Voldemort had such a hideous appearance. Such a thought. How could she allow herself to entertain the thought? They were still in the same house. She was taking terrible liberties. The Averys and the Lestrange brothers had been stuck in the little forest of thorns that Potter the Squib had created, and they were having trouble getting them out of it. Narcissa's focus had been in keeping quiet and feigning she didn't care when her sister spoke of Draco, told her he was alive and well and in Potter's company. Her heart had beaten then like the wings of a swan taking flight. And she had seen, she must have seen, the barest glimpse, the smallest sign. A moment of recognition in Severus Snape. Something that only she could see because only she was feeling it. Hidden in the corner of his mouth, that sour mouth of thin lips just like hers. There had been an infinite amount of pride and relief as he touched that strange forest of thorns. that Narcissa thought was quite pretty. She had cut a little branch, and she kept it hidden in her underwear drawer. She had known without understanding. She had known, and even now, when everyone downstairs thought they knew. Even now, Narcissa knew better. They thought that Snape was motivated by loyalty to Dumbledore or greed for himself. That he had believed the promises of honey from that old goat, or that he wanted to make his own kingdom. Narcissa knew better, and she wasn't telling, oh no. Someone who wanted power for himself would take risks, but never so high as to come near death. Because with death, they would lose everything. Those kinds of people would retreat and beg for mercy, and above all, they would try to save themselves. But Snape was not that kind of man. Snape's victory wasn't his life, was it? He wouldn't mind dying as long as Voldemort fell. He could die and still win, and that was a completely different sort of opponent. Narcissa knew it, and she wasn't saying because she hoped with every fiber of her body that he would succeed. She had sent him a hopeless message, but she had hope. She stayed in the tower until she couldn't see the swan anymore, until it had blended with the off-white clouds. They were almost done with breakfast. People had been divided between those that could hardly manage to swallow down a cup of tea or a small glass of juice, and those who had loaded their plates with sausages and eggs in preparation for an exhausting day. Severus had forced himself to eat as usual, small glass of juice, piece of fruit, tea, and toast. In front of him, Sirius was eating as if he thought this would be the last time he would ever get to taste anything. Not a huge amount, but each bite was relished with fervor. By his side, Remus had picked a monstrosity made of chocolate to help clear his head. Everybody was dealing as best they could. Pomona Sprout and Madame Pomfrey both had a 1,000-yard stare. Understandable. Ernie had been a Hufflepuff, and Poppy knew that many other students would get hurt. On a corner of the table, Hagrid was staring at his tea and eating mechanically. From time to time, Professor Slughorn elbowed him gently to remind him to keep eating. Slughorn had taken the hedonist route and was eating the most fantastic omelette accompanied with a single shot of liquor. To his left, Minerva was eating, as if not doing so were a particularly personal insult. The way she spread butter over her toast or stirred her tea spoke of a profound indignation. It was the fear. Minerva always got particularly worked up with the fear and terror as she considered them the worst kind of attack. Having someone come and attempt to kill her was one thing, but having them try to make her feel afraid. To suffer hours before the event, oh no, none of that. This is also why she always dismissed Trelawney's yearly predictions of a student's death. If you were to die, so be it, but there was no need to die in spirit long before the fact. She was the head of Gryffindor. She would not have the school tainted with the acrid smell of terror. She put the teacup down in the saucer, making a very gentle clink sound.
"Don't even think about it,"
she said to Severus, firmly, very firmly. The tone with which she dealt with the worst kind of mischievous students. The tone reserved for Filch's most dramatic tantrums. The tone she had used when Black played that prank. Severus felt himself swallow and tense instantly. Because he might be headmaster of Hogwarts now, but he had been her student far longer. The table was lost in its own thoughts. But Sirius raised his electric blue eyes and looked at Severus while he began eating, like a dog laying in the sun that raises an attentive ear. Remus, too, had turned o's so slightly and looked at the two of them curiously with eyes that were so gentle and kind that Severus couldn't stand looking at them right now.
"No," Minerva said. "Just no, Severus. No."
The twins' theory that she had some secret power of clairvoyance got new strength. How had she noticed? The whole table, the whole great hall was distracted, and Severus was being exquisitely discreet. How could she notice when Madame Pomfrey, trained healer, had not? The mark on Severus's left forearm was burning. At first it had been easy to ignore, but the brand was Voldemort's spell, created by him and cast only by him. When he had invented it so that he could call his followers, he had not left space for rebellion and disregard. The mark now burned with a white heat, hot and intense, taking over all his arm from the palm to the head of the shoulder. It was not the pain. He could ignore the pain, intense as it was. He could get something for it. Plus, Pomfrey's apprentices had been investigating Chang's solution of casting Glacio to stop the worst of a curse. As long as he had free use of his right arm, Severus could work and ignore the fire taking over his left arm. It was not the pain. It was that Voldemort was calling, and he was thinking of answering. It made quite a lot of sense. Philip, or whatever had taken him, because it was hard to believe that he was a traitor, must have arrived at Voldemort with quite a lot to say. This was why Voldemort was now calling for him with such insistence, and the longer Severus delayed the answer, the worse it would look. The Dark Lord had believed him before, had wanted to believe Severus, saw him as one of his favorites. Was it so outlandish that if Severus went to him, he would not believe him once more? Severus's lies were sweet and fresh. Would he really reject them this time? Perhaps. Perhaps the trust was broken and Voldemort would not take any excuses. Perhaps this time nothing that came from Severus's mouth would be admitted. But perhaps not. And Severus thought it was extremely selfish not to at least try. How could he stay in the school and make everyone fight without going there first and seeing if he could change the world once more with a lie? I can see you thinking, Minerva hissed. I will Petrificus Totalus you myself, Severus. You're not going anywhere. I don't know what this is about, said Sirius, putting down one of his six different glasses of juice. But I can sit on top of him if you want me to, Minerva. Remus said nothing, but he put a warm and heavy hand on his thigh. Just a hand. And it was stronger than any chain.
"Good morning, sir," said Percy Weasley with his usual tone of bureaucratic politeness as the back door to the Hog's Head opened for him. The pub didn't open for business until the afternoon. Aberforth Dumbledore gave a grunt that could be interpreted as a greeting.
"As per the new ministerial resolution for hostelry, all business owners and or managers must have a standardized BK-800 item on the premises. I'm hereby delivering the cited implement so your establishment will be in accordance with ordinance."
Percy lifted the big and heavy bucket to signal that it was the standardized BK-800 item. He put it back down, although a little bit closer to Aberforth.
"This is a bucket," Aberforth pointed.
He managed to express how low were his opinions of the ministry regulations in general and Percy Weasley in just those four words. While his brother Albus had been a man of genial disposition, Aberforth was sour and bitter.
"But no, sir,"
Percy answered easily. This was just as when he had started to work in cauldron legislation. People refused to acknowledge the importance of standardization and minimum requirements.
"It is a metal container, with an open top and flat bottom as described in the rules for BK-500 to BK-900 vessels, with a supplement designed to facilitate holding and carrying it."
Aberforth stared at Percy in disbelief before quickly adopting the general look of resignation of those confronted with the absurd logic of bureaucrats. He bent to take the bucket by the handle and bring it in. Percy was already stepping away, satisfied with how quickly he had solved this, when Aberforth's voice called him again. Albus, or rather Dumbledore, because he was the one people thought about when the name was introduced, had had a nice voice, profound and majestic and clear. Aberforth's voice was like crumpled paper and broken glass.
"This bucket is full of grain and wine,"
he said, and at the same time he sounded as if he had dropped a handful of rusty nails in said bucket.
"I can assure you, sir, it is just as established by the regulation. Is the minister expecting many attacks of African firebirds in English pubs?"
I wouldn't know, sir. I am not in the Department of Magical Creatures, because wheat grain soaked in wine is used to tame firebirds."
Because really, even if Albus had once said rather unkindly that he wasn't sure whether Aberforth knew how to read and write, Aberforth was far from being a moron. As it turned out, he was aware of the terribly obscure process for capturing and taming the equally exotic firebirds. Percy just knew he had to deliver the bucket. He didn't completely understand why. He just knew that the bucket's absence meant a roof on fire, a stone tower that grew so hot that it crumbled, and a room with the floor covered in blood. It meant six
perfectly preventable deaths. I am sure that the Ministry took into consideration many reasons when drawing up this rule, said Percy, his voice faltering a little bit. Firebirds, a bit like a phoenix, but with a propensity to burn down fields and buildings. The cannonballs of nature.
Did it? And what considerations were those?
Percy coughed and took a breath to ground himself. Usually he was much better at avoiding questions, but he was tired and hungry and very impatient.
Considerations? He bit over the word. From the trusted advisers of the minister. Sir, if you are questioning the ministry's decision or my authority, I will have to write you up. I was merely expressing my curiosity,
Aberforth answered in a tone that, rather than sugary, was like cheap saccharin.
It is not every day that a humble innkeeper like myself gets a personal visit from the junior assistant to the minister, and to deliver me an 800 bucket, too.
When all this was done, Percy was going to go very far away where no one spoke English.
Mr. Dumbledore,
he said in answer before nodding and disappearing. Aberforth took the bucket. That was what mattered. The Patronus arrived as they were beginning to organize. Since they still didn't know the nature of the attack, or if there was going to be an attack at all, who knew? Maybe Voldemort wouldn't want to damage his beloved Hogwarts. Maybe Severus would dodge Minerva and everyone else and go to him and fix it all with a pretty lie. For now, they were quickly reviewing their resources and listing ideas. Madame Pomfrey was glad to say that since she had been stocking up on medicine and training a few volunteers, she could offer medical assistance to more than a third of the castle at the same time. Professor Slughorn had an adequate supply of antidotes ready. They had created enough Protego-imbued cloak to dress 36 people. The sky was the usual white-gray of English winters, so they didn't notice it at first as the Patronus descended in circles toward them. It was a beautiful swan, elegant and majestic and with a hidden strength in each flap of its wings. It spoke with a voice that was soft and sad, and Severus couldn't believe that they had thought that it had been his. He was sure he had never sounded like that, so dreadfully beautiful and sad. After it delivered its message, the Patronus vanished in soft tendrils of silver mist that were just like the voice, tender and fragile and so easily torn apart and broken. Severus was a spy. He hadn't wanted to be. His interests had always been in potions and music, but when he had become one, he had strived to be one of the best. The Patronus was gone, but he could recite the message almost word for word. He knows, don't come. He will kill you. He prepares to attack Hogwarts. No mercy. Giants, werewolves, vampires, harpies, firebirds, dementors. Wizards only at the end. Not only did Severus remember all of it, he still had enough attention to notice Remus making a signal to the twins. For some unfathomable reason, Remus hadn't been satisfied with Severus's assurance to Minerva that he wasn't going anywhere, and had made the twins shadow him in preparation for more drastic measures.
Yes, why would I resort to such underhanded methods? Was all Remus had to say on the topic.
In any case, they couldn't dwell too much on it. The message was a wonderful gift, even if it painted a terrible picture, wave after wave of creatures that could cross Hogwarts' defenses and that would seep out all of their energies before Voldemort and its Death Eaters stepped in. Even if Hogwarts' defenders caused a great deal of damage to Voldemort's forces, he wouldn't withdraw or step back because he didn't care about all those dark creatures he was sending first. They were just a convenient method of injuring them and tiring them out before he decided to engage. They could kill them all and Voldemort wouldn't care. It was unexpectedly practical and ruthless. Like the duelist that poisons his opponent the previous night, it was the kind of plan Lovegood would have come up with. He had never thought that Voldemort possessed such invention. Then again, that the message had come from Narcissa Malfoy was also unexpected and so surprising as to be bewildering. It seemed to Severus that it would be best not to think much about expectations and predictions and slim chances of victory, and instead just set to work because who could tell what else would happen?
She was the model girl of the family, whispered Sirius in the background.
Dementors shouldn't be a problem, Ron was saying, already clearing a table to draw up a plan. But I've no idea how to deal with vampires. I think Charlie was the last in the family to study them.
A considerable reserve of aconite,
Slughorn was telling Sprout.
Study earrings.
Thunum was showing the twins a pair of earrings shaped like eagles' heads.
To cancel the noise. I think they just have a muffliato on them. Only people can see that you can't hear anything. I think we should work in shifts, and with them people could get some sleep.
Of course, beheading would work. It works with every creature, not just vampires.
We have armors. Vampires can't fight someone in armor. If a humble student can intervene in the council, announced Theodore Knott, whose baseline mode of speaking was something between a jibe and sarcasm. Parkinson has finally snapped, and she is hugging Lavender Brown to death, but Till too. Not the nerd one, the other one. She is also hugging. The Dark Lord wanted all of his army available, so all of his army he would have. However, this was going to take a bit of time, because the army was scattered all over his territory, and only wizards were able to apparate instantly. It wasn't mere apparition, though. Bellatrix was finding that some of his followers were less eager than her to jump to action, and what's more, that mere will and devotion wasn't enough to shorten distances. The vice-governor of Ireland, the governor wasn't available when they called, said he could easily send them as many giants as they wanted, and he hoped to do it in a timely manner if that was their wish. That wasn't a problem. The problem would be bringing them back to the island, because the locals, barbarians that they were, kept fighting the Death Eaters sent to clean the wizarding population, and once the giants were out, they wouldn't let them back in. They just wouldn't. Losing the giants meant a weaker grip of the conquered territory, and in the shorter term, a very long rant from the vice-governor regarding the savagery of the locals, and a recount of every little sign of opposition he had faced. Not only were the pureblood families not being cooperative, inexplicable, but it seemed that they were working with muggles. Bellatrix believed it. They were all little more than smart animals. Of course they would work together. Apparently the muggles, all of them, kept more in contact and had tighter nets of communication than wizards, which allowed the Irish wizards to receive support from the continent. Just 2 weeks ago, Diggory had been spotted there, even though their intel said he was in Norway planning an attack on Azkaban. But Bellatrix didn't care about that now. Voldemort wanted giants, and he would have his giants to bring Hogwarts to the ground. They would think about the stupid island and their stupid, dirty wizards later. And if they gave any trouble, they would be crushed like a bug under a shoe until all opposition ceased. The governor of Gibraltar had been more helpful, even if they did have to endure his accent. A flock of firebirds would arrive to England in just a few hours. He was recruiting bands of trolls, and the port keys would be ready in a matter of minutes if only they got some special permissions from the Department of Transport. Bella was sure they wouldn't give them back, and that they would use them for smuggling, but Voldemort hadn't minded, pleased at the mention of a whole flock of firebirds. There were some letters written by his own hand and bearing his seal, orders for the ministry to prepare for the arrival of the damned giants, to give the blanket permission to that crook in Gibraltar, it didn't matter, they would take it back, to call the Dementors from Azkaban and the Wizengamot, and to expedite the way to Hogwarts for all the troops. The last order still held a bit of the warmth of his hand, or so Bellatrix wanted to believe as she held them close to her chest. She would go dispatch them now. As she went to take the stairs to the top floors and the aviary, she noticed the breakfast tray abandoned on a side table. The people in the ballroom had only now realized that the werewolf was dead. Amateur, she would have kept him alive for weeks, and were debating whether or not to paint something with his blood. But the tray. Here is a funny thing about the Black family. Most of them were Slytherins. They would like to say that all of them, Sirius didn't count, neither did Andromeda, and they would also like to say that it was so because they were perfectly pure-blooded, and Slytherin was the house for pure-blood families. The truth is that most of them were Slytherins because they were gifted with a certain intuitive knowledge, a deep ability for discerning and noticing the unseen. Andromeda saw it at times in her daughter, even if it wasn't very strong. Regulus had it to the utmost degree. Narcissa had it. Bellatrix had it. So, despite the betrayal that had the house in chaos and her duty to Voldemort and the raucous party in the ballroom, Bellatrix saw an abandoned tea tray and thought that she hadn't seen her sister for a while, and that it was very much unlike her to leave the tray there. She held that thought while she went up the stairs with the letters firmly held in her left hand and her wand in the right. With each step, she twisted the thought a bit more, until eventually something leaked out of it. Narcissa was the cleverest out of all the three Black sisters. Given how quiet she was, nobody would have expected it. She really didn't look like much yet. She was 1 point smarter than Bella. 1 point wasn't a lot, but given how smart Bella was, it was plenty for general purposes. Narcissa also had the added advantage of not being insane, even if her mind had endured some great strain in the last few years. "What were you doing?" Bellatrix asked her as Narcissa came down from the spiral stairs that took to the aviary. Bella was standing in the door, almost crowding Narcissa in the narrow landing. Bellatrix had taken a very good spot, lots of empty space on her back if she had to move or dodge, while Narcissa could only go back up and not very far. Narcissa looked at her calmly, a bit like a sheep or a cow.
Bella, she said,
like a little girl that greets an older sister she doesn't understand and is afraid of. Like a little girl that still plays with dolls and is forced to share a table with a young woman who nowadays plays with boys and with blood.
What were you doing?
Bella was still careful not to crumple the letters given to her by the Dark Lord, but her grip on her wand tightened to the points of her fingers turning white. Narcissa considered for a moment, and because she was just one point smarter, she saw that Bellatrix didn't know. She didn't know, but she suspected something, and she wouldn't stop until she got an answer because her insanity made her inhumanly persistent. Narcissa could lie, and maybe Bellatrix would believe her, and maybe not. The actual fact was that in this, Bellatrix didn't matter. She wasn't the one who worried Narcissa. She made a decision. She was smarter.
"Sending some letters, evidently," she said,
knowing that she sounded nervous and weak and like a terrible liar. It was unbelievable that Narcissa Black Malfoy would lie so badly, but Bella thought her stupid, so she would take it. She would think that she was so much cleverer and could spot her sister's clumsy lies.
"What letters?"
Bellatrix tilted her head, and a strand of black hair fell over that beautiful corner between neck and shoulder.
"Who do you need to write to? Everyone you know is here."
Narcissa lowered her gaze and bit her lip.
"Not everyone. Honestly, Bella, it's nothing. You shouldn't concern yourself." "Who, Narcissa? Tell me who." "It's just Lucius and I, we've been having problems, and really it's nothing that affects you." "A lover? You expect me to believe you have a lover?"
No, no, no. If she did, it would be wonderful, but she didn't expect it, no.
"Honestly, sissy, how stupid is that? Expelliarmus!"
The wand jumped from Narcissa's hand. She hadn't expected it, but she wouldn't have been able to stop it even if she had. This was Bella. Who could best Bella in a duel? Bellatrix could hardly hold the letters, plus Narcissa's wand in one hand. One of the letters slipped her grip and floated gently to the floor. Another had creased.
"Priori incantato,"
said Bella, pointing at her sister's wand. And right away the ghost of the last spell, the Patronus, came over the wand like a beacon.
"Expecto Patronum?"
Bellatrix looked a bit surprised and a bit lost.
"But there aren't any dementors around."
The words hung in there. Narcissa waited in silence for Bellatrix to figure it out. She couldn't go back up, nor would she achieve anything by doing so. She might try to push forward and pray that Bella was so confused that she suddenly became a useless fighter and let her through, but she would have the same problem later, only in a corridor rather than the stairs. Today of all days, any strange behavior, any suspicion, would not find Bella's or McNair's special interrogation, but Voldemort himself going through your mind. Today, even if she managed to fool Bella, the encounter would linger in her mind and Voldemort would notice it. Narcissa had seen him do it plenty of times, getting stray thoughts from the people around him, even when he hadn't uttered a word or moved his wand. He would see Narcissa's lie in Bellatrix's mind, and even if he believed it too, he would still turn to look at the source, get the details directly from Narcissa's mind. Narcissa couldn't have that. She didn't know if her message would really help Snape. She hoped it did. She hoped it allowed him to prepare better for the attack. But she knew for certain that if they learned he had been warned, they would change their plan, and then he would have nothing.
"You used it to send a message,"
Bellatrix said slowly, the words falling from her full mouth like pearls.
"Just like the Order used to do. Dumbledore's invention."
The Chinese had been doing it for centuries, but fine, Dumbledore's invention. Narcissa took a tiny step back and put one of her hands, beautiful, beautiful hands, no other witch had hands like hers, over her belly and over her heart. "It is well known. The best way to lie is to say the truth, just a different truth." She would have her believe that she was contacting Draco, protecting him, which was true enough. Let her think that she had written to him and not to the man that she knew would save him. Snape would protect Draco, like he had done after Lucius had had that bout of temper and punished him. Plus, Draco was with Potter and Snape was protecting Potter. He would also look after Draco.
"Is that traitor son of yours, isn't it? You've been helping him, telling him to move when we got close.
Hold that thought, Bella, hold that thought, and forget about Snape and his true motivations. If you don't know what your enemy truly wants, then you don't know how they will act, so hold that thought and think about a lost boy. If they hadn't found him yet, wantless and underage, they would not find him now, almost turned into a man. Narcissa knew that, so let Bellatrix waste her attention in him and forget about the man who dared to lie. All that remained now was ensuring that Voldemort didn't learn about this, that he didn't force the truth out of Narcissa, and that he wouldn't even know that there was a truth to find.
"You know, Bella,"
said Narcissa Malfoy, Narcissa black with sudden hardness in her voice.
"I don't like you. You are my sister, but I don't think that I have ever liked you. You think that because you're my sister I'll treat you differently?"
Bella took a step forward, still blocking the door. The letters were all on the floor now, or terribly creased as her hands tightened into fists. Her emotions always took her over whenever they discussed Draco.
"In fact,"
Narcissa said, daring for once to interrupt Bella,
"I don't think anyone likes you. I don't. Lucius doesn't. Severus doesn't. None of the other Death Eaters like you. Not a single one of them. They might fear you, but they don't like you. I think your husband might have liked you before your wedding, but never after that."
"Shut up!"
"And I know that he doesn't like you,"
said Narcissa with such coldness that it must have been true.
"He will use you and will bed you. But to him you are nothing more than a house elf serving him, a whiny, irritating house elf. And nobody loves house elves, Bella."
"Shut up! Flatulo!"
Narcissa sidestepped the curse easily. The wall behind her cracked with the impact. There had always been such potency in Bella's spells. People spoke of Grindelwald and Dumbledore and Voldemort, but Narcissa had never seen something quite like her.
"Do you know who he likes?"
she went on. Because she couldn't afford to give her any respite, not a second to think and call others. If Lucius came, he would stop her. If he came, he would stop Bella, and he would take Narcissa down to Voldemort, who would rummage through her mind and see everything. And afterwards, Lucius would crucio Narcissa to death. He would talk some sense into Bella, and they would go slowly about it, just as they had gone with that poor wolf boy.
"Me."
The word in Narcissa's mouth, that mouth with too sad and too thin lips, was like a gunshot.
"Do you know who else he likes?" "Severus Snape."
Bella took a step back as if she had been stabbed. "Even now you can hear him rage. You can hear him bleed from the betrayal because he cares, Bella. He cares more than he ever cared about you.
If he cared even a little, he would have listened when you warned him."
"Whore! Whore! Shut up!"
"You know it's true."
"No, no, no, no! Traitor! Poison! Your words are poison! I don't believe you! I don't hear them!"
She was right. The words were poison. She was also wrong. She believed each and every one of them.
"On the contrary, my dear, I'm very loyal."
Narcissa spoke softly and calmly. She had always envied Severus Snape's control over his voice, but today she managed to sound like the touch of rose petals.
"I saw you! Betrayer! Liar! Liar!"
"I never said that I was loyal to him. Never took the mark or swore an oath."
Narcissa knew what was coming. Even if she had had her wand in her hand, she knew that against Bella, it would be nothing more than an expensive twig, and it would do her little good. She had her voice, though, and a mind that was sharper than anyone thought, and the resolution to protect her son and the man helping him at all costs.
"I am loyal to my son, Bella,"
she said with the strength of someone who speaks the most absolute truth, something reserved for the gods.
"And I will do everything in my hand to keep him away from harm. If you were a mother, you would understand."
It was a terrible blow. It was the worst thing Narcissa could have said, and she knew it very well. No insult to Voldemort, no offense to the cause, would awake in Bella such blind fury as the reminder that she could not bear him a son. She had always been so sure that if only she could conceive, he would have loved her then. There was a flash of green light, and a sound like that of a body falling to the floor. Then there was only silence and the sobs of a woman. Narcissus had died without fear or pain. Bellatrix regretted it immediately, not because it was her sister, but because a traitor deserved a bigger and longer punishment. Narcissa, for her part, only regretted the years she could not protect Draco better, the pain he suffered at Lucius's hands. But she was content in the knowledge that she had done better now. She had fought those who would harm her son and helped those who would protect him when she couldn't. She had gotten a clean death free of torture. She felt like she couldn't ask for more. There was a ring of bells as the door to the store opened. The clerk looked up at the flustered young man who came in. It seemed like the wind had picked up because his hair was a disaster, an explosion of orange curls.
"Good morning, sir."
"Afternoon, lad. What do you need?"
Is it already?"
"Afternoon."
"Gone 2 hours past noon. How could I have you?"
"Oh dear, I'm losing track of time."
He looked very upset about it, and like he hadn't gotten much sleep recently.
"Yep, happens to all of us. Work and work and no time for yourself.
You have to live in the country to appreciate time, that's what my father always said. Now tell me, how could I help you?"
"Yes, he pointed. Could I get that one, with the black handle?"
"This one?"
"There's a fiberglass handle to absorb vibrations, and the head is carbon steel. Very durable. But listen, boy, if you're just doing some simple repairs at home..."
He glanced at the young man who looked like the heaviest thing he had ever lifted might be a small flower pot or a couple of books.
"You might want this one better. General purpose. Rubber grips so might slip. Much cheaper."
"I thank you, I like the other one."
"It also has rubber grip, right?"
"Yes, of course."
"That was much better. Just now I don't take advantage of my clients. Others might, but I don't like it."
"It may not be what you need."
Yes, certainly. Thank you. Much appreciated. But I like that one. How much is it?"
£26.99.
"Yes, here."
He hurriedly got a £50 note.
"Oh, and the nails. Do you have iron nails?"
"All nails are steel nowadays, lad," the clerk said patiently. Kids these days didn't even know how to hang a picture.
"But do you have some iron ones?"
"I might have some old ones in the back, but they're not good. The ones that don't break, they bend."
"That's all right. I'll take them."
So he went and got some unsellable old iron nails, which the young man attempted to take in the nest of his arms, and when that didn't work, on his shirt. He looked very grateful when he was given a plastic bag for his purchase, and he left without waiting for the change.
"Well, someone has broken something old and is in a hurry to repair it," the store clerk thought to himself.
The market stopped burning at mid-morning. Voldemort had finally accepted that Severus was not coming. The absence of pain was a relief, but Severus couldn't help thinking that now that Voldemort wasn't calling, he would be focusing his attention on preparing the attack. Then again, Severus knew Voldemort was still a bit upset. Lovegood had remembered the Karrow's box, the one they had been using to keep the charade up. When they opened it, Severus found a very nasty message from the Dark Lord addressed to him, in which he was informed that no amount of begging would spare his life, together with very specific threats and commentary on his ancestry. The most feared wizard in the world, reduced to sending insulting messages. Luna's face had been delightful. But he was coming. Silly, angry messages or no, he was coming, and the fact was worsened by the knowledge that they couldn't kill him, not unless all the other Horcruxes had been destroyed, and they knew this was not the case. He couldn't be killed, but perhaps he could be injured, and in any case they were all certain that they were not going to flee. They would not abandon Hogwarts and its treasures. More importantly, they would not make Harry solely responsible for defeating Voldemort. That wasn't fair. But just as it wasn't fair that a child, 17 already, but a child, had to vanquish Voldemort, it wasn't fair for all the other children in the school either. They shouldn't have to be dragged into battle. This very sensible thought managed to open two very ugly discussions. The first one was with the children themselves, who felt like they were mature and informed enough to choose to stay and fight. Those who had turned 17 already said that they were not going anywhere, followed by the sixth-years, who said that 16 is the new 17, Professor, and since the riots had generated mostly from the fifth-years at the time, the current fifth-years said they were staying too.
The fourth youth tried to argue that Potter had participated in the Triwizard Tournament at that age, but they were dismissed. In the end, only those who looked old enough to pass as fifth years managed to stay. Everyone else was deemed too young. Mostly, if you couldn't evade the twins' grappling, then you had no business staying and were put in a room to wait. They would all be evacuated before nightfall, get them as far away from the school as possible, and above all, without being discovered. No one wanted to know what would happen if the Death Eaters realized they were taking the children away. Cho Chang had drawn a map and written down a code. She would be staying, but the thought that if they managed to contact Diggory and Crumb, they would help take the children to Europe and house them there. No matter what happened tonight at Hogwarts, those kids would survive. It remained only the question of who would take them. Evidently the kids couldn't go alone, but they also couldn't spare many adults to go with them. Not when every able wizard and witch would be needed tonight. And here came argument number two. Because Severus had made it very clear who should be in charge of the kids, whereas that person did not see it that way. No, Remus said. For Merlin's sake, no, I'm the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. And the last person that should go, take Amanda and Aurora. They're sensible and tough. If you think that there should be two people, then choose someone to help you, but you are going. Of course I'm not, Severus. I'm not leaving you here. This is not open to discussion. You're going, Severus said in a final tone with some hints of irritation. Not open to discussion, Remus exclaimed, opening his eyes. Have you gone mad? I believe I have made myself clear, Severus answered, trying hard to keep calm. Very. Remus was oozing that acrid politeness he used as defense. I'm still not going, and I don't care how many times you repeat that nonsense. The fight was ugly and more upsetting than the oncoming battle. It was like seeing your parents fight about something obscure that you didn't understand. You just wanted them to stop, and please be nice. I am the DADA teacher. I'm an expert on dark creatures, and you have got a message telling you that he is going to use them. There was something in Remus's voice, and a wet quality in his eyes that was absolutely heartbreaking. He had been rejected so many times in his life, and now this. You need me here! Come on, Mooney, don't be an arse and give this to him, will you? Sirius said as he finished laying his old charmed spiderweb over the entrance to one of the secret tunnels. He just wants to make sure that you survive. And are there for Harry? Remus stopped mid-sentence and blinked in surprise. Severus looked like he was about to throw up, and he also looked like Sirius was speaking the truth. This was quite unbalancing. Remus was used to being right. He was the one who reined Sirius back when he was being impulsive, the one who told the twins not to when they got an idea that was extra mad, the one who told Severus not to be dense and stop denying happiness for himself. He was always right. It was very strange to suddenly not be. But I'm staying, Sirius went on. His eyes had a spark in them that foretold nothing good. I've already decided. If we lose, I'm blowing myself up and taking everyone I can with me. Cause as much damage as I can. On that note, he added, raising his voice for everyone around to hear, dibs on Lucius Malfoy, he's mine. The Slytherins working nearby, applying wax to one flight of stairs, as good as destroying them, looked up, startled. It hadn't occurred to them that you could claim people, and now Black had gone and demanded Lucius.
Can he do that?
Dibs on Parkinson's father!
Screamed Theodore Knott, mostly because he enjoyed messing with her.
No, you don't!
Hansa yelled back. She was about to punch him in the arm, but he sidestepped her quickly.
Dibs is dibs,
Theo said smugly as Pansy fumed. In the background, Zabini was nodding his head as if this made sense to him. The ancient law of dual dibs.
Dibs on Bellatrix Lestrange,
Pansy said then, not loudly, but enunciating very clearly.
You can't get dibs on Bella,
Sirius told her, still standing next to Severus and Remus with wet, shining eyes.
She's the best duelist of our time. She would kill you in a blink. None of you tadpoles fought her, you hear me? She's too big. I don't want any of you crossing paths with her.
He's right,
said Remus after clearing his throat. Probably because with one look, Severus had taken his heart from his chest and lifted it all the way there.
The strain should be left to adults. I am going to kill her,
Pansy said through gritted teeth.
Pansy did, no. Besides, you're not even family, she's my cousin.
Then give back your dibs on Malfoy.
Never.
It seems like it has been shut down for months, said Draco reasonably. He was a very reasonable person, the most reasonable of his immediate peers, that was for sure.
Just a quick look, Hermione begged. I know it sounds absurd that the shop is closed, but I just have this nagging feeling that George needs something.
It was perfectly illogical, and so Hermione had a lot of trouble trying to describe the burning sensation in the back of her mind, a soft but insistent pull that she should go find George Weasley immediately because he had gotten himself in trouble. She was not the only one feeling that way. Oliver Woods had a similar feeling, only in his case was Fred. Fred Weasley needed help. Why would he suddenly think that? He didn't know. Oliver had had a bit of a hard year. He had it better than most, so he wasn't complaining, but the year had been hard. Oliver just wanted to play Quidditch. It was all he cared about, and more people were interfering with it and ruining the enjoyment. First, Oliver was handsome, and even if he didn't have a particularly heroic chin, he had a beautiful sunny smile and he was a Gryffindor, so the Ministry was pressuring him to make public statements and lend his image to counteract the Crumb Diggory campaign. Oliver didn't want to do that, he just wanted to play Quidditch. But saying no was becoming more and more difficult as the pressure increased. At the same time, simply saying no wasn't enough for some people, so Oliver got used to getting dirty looks because he didn't take a defiant stance like Diggory. Apparently, as a Gryffindor, he was expected to openly denounce the government and get himself killed in a public duel or something. That wasn't even the worst part. He could ignore all that as long as he still got to play. When he was in the air or when he was planning strategies and moves, it didn't matter what other people thought or said. He had been training hard and giving his all in the game, keeping a good average overall even when he knew he wasn't playing his very best due to the stress. Still, the captain had told him that he might have to bench him for the next few games. Lucius Malfoy had strongly suggested that it would benefit the team's performance, and Malfoy knew nothing of Quidditch, so they had all understood what his words really meant. They probably weren't going to completely cut him out of the team, but they would reduce his time playing, and that meant that Oliver would have fewer opportunities to really shine, and he certainly wouldn't get a bonus. That might be the worst thing, or what felt bitterest to Oliver. He had always liked playing for the game's sake, for the strategy and the wonderful rush of the victory and the delight of a game well played. Now he couldn't even have that because he was thinking about performance objectives and bonuses. He hated it. He hated the idea of a bonus because you shouldn't need one to play your best. But the thing was that he really needed those bonuses. Oliver needed all the money he could earn. There was something that was making his year difficult. Difficult isn't the same as hard. It means that there was some sort of struggle that Oliver had to overcome, but he didn't suffer for it, or he suffered agreeably. Last year, at the start of the season, Oliver had rented a semi-detached house with two bedrooms and one full bathroom, plus a half-bathroom that was a serious lifesaver. It was more space than what a single young man needed, but the extra room might be used by friends and family visiting, so it wasn't anything out of the ordinary, and Oliver had liked the location. And in that house, with two bedrooms and one bathroom and a half, and nosy neighbors on one side, Oliver was hiding five people wanted by the Ministry. This was the difficult thing that Oliver did happily and the reason why he was so short on money. It had started with Angelina Johnson and Penelope Clearwater knocking on his door in the middle of the night. It had been back when Dumbledore was alive and Voldemort wasn't so visible, so they all pretended nothing bad was really happening. Bad things were happening, though, and Oliver ushered the girls inside without questions. Penelope left a few weeks later. She had contacts in the Ministry, and through them they got her on a transport to Calais. She returned to England in April and had been working from another house, forging papers for the Half-Bloods. Angelina stayed, and Penelope was soon replaced by Katie Bell, who came to them with just the clothes on her back, desperately trying to stop a bleeding gush in her abdomen. Oliver had a game that day, so he had to go and play and pretend nothing was wrong, not knowing if when he returned later that day he would find Katie, one of his chasers, one of his girls, dead. He hadn't. She had survived, and Oliver had been so angry and so worried that he had stopped each and every one of the Quaffles sent his way, and even the Bludger. He got a nice bonus that allowed him to buy health potions without the alchemist writing down his name. The next day, Alicia Spinett and Elizabeth Pine, who had been a chaser too, came to the house not daring to ask whether Katie had managed to arrive the day before. They were all his players, his wonderful girls. Oliver had kept them all, even if there was no space and they couldn't go out or make much noise in case the Critchleys next door heard them and informed the ministry. And 2 weeks ago, they had also welcomed a half-dead Lee Jordan. It had been a very close call, both because Lee had been severely wounded and because he had left a trail. There had been special operators and even a branded Death Eater going down the street investigating, and that same afternoon, Oliver had sent an owl to the team's spokesman, telling him yes to the bloody interview with the Prophet. He would say whatever they wanted. In fact, they could go ahead and write whatever answers they liked, and he would sign it. As a Gryffindor, Oliver would have liked to go the Diggory route and keep saying no and maybe duel someone. That would certainly help with the rage, but sometimes courage is not in a big fight, but in doing it again and again and again, day after day, secret and hidden. In any case, today Oliver was coming home thinking about Fred Weasley and the biting feeling that he might be in trouble. He was greeted by Angelina, who, as one of the few who had managed to keep her wand, was always the one who came to the lobby.
"Hey, Oliver, weird question, but I've got like a sudden premonition or something. Have you heard anything of the twins lately? Of Fred? I've a bad feeling about Fred."
Oliver took a careful breath. A good keeper had to keep a clear head at all times, and above all, don't fall for the feints.
"Did you take divination?" he asked. "You didn't, did you?" "No, It's just weird. Alicia made us all a cup of tea and is looking at the leaves. But she only took divination 1 year."
"I tell you, we have to go!"
came a broken voice from upstairs, followed by adamant hushing. They really couldn't make any noise.
"And Lee's going crazy because he thinks the twins are in trouble and he wants us all to go," added Angelina. "But he can barely stand. That's what we're telling him. But he's frantic and, I don't know, he's getting to me. I just have this nagging feeling that I should go get Fred."
Marcus Flint found Suruchi Subhadra waiting outside. This was unexpected because they hadn't mixed that much and there was no reason why she would know where Marcus's family lived. Unexpected, but not surprising. She was dressed with trousers and a thick jacket, and her long hair was braided and stuffed inside a hat that tied with a ribbon under her chin. She looked cute and ready for combat. Marcus noted that rather than heels, her boots had a flat and thick sole. Given how careful Subhadra was about her appearance, this meant something important.
"You got the call too, eh, Flint?" she said.
She kept her back very straight and her tummy tucked in like dancers do.
"I felt something from the Patil sisters, but no Slytherins. Can you believe it?"
"Sabini," Marcus said. "Gregory Goyle, Graham Montague, Mafalda Pusa, and Luciana Fowle."
Subhadra looked surprised, but quickly accepted it. Marcus Flint had always been well-liked in Slytherin. He was not a model student, but he was good enough at Quidditch, and if anyone went to him with a problem, he would beat up the cause of said problem.
"They are 6th and 7th years, right?" Suruchi said. "In Hogwarts?"
Marcus nodded.
"Father says that they're preparing to attack tomorrow morning. He is going to grant his brands to the survivors of the battle,"
Marcus said dryly, pointing at his left forearm.
"Father was very excited about Demetrius going and making a name for himself. He's my brother-in-law," he explained.
His sister wasn't allowed to go because even though the Dark Lord accepted women in his lines, even Grindelwald had been hesitant about it. She was pregnant at the moment. Marcus's father hadn't expected his son to go. Marcus wasn't a particularly good wizard and had to retake his last year at Hogwarts. He was a disappointment that couldn't aspire to bring any honor to the family. That he didn't dishonor it further by being a squib was enough nowadays. However, Marcus had been perfectly able to cast Petrificus Totalus and take his father's wand.
So,
he wasn't here making himself useful, nobody was. The deployment would begin soon. Already the first dark creatures were beginning to line up by the outskirts of the Forbidden Forest and around Hogsmeade, waiting for someone, a wizard, a human, to give them the order. And they would attack from the north, taking cover in the forest until they were right before the castle. There would also be a sneak attack from the east, because there was absolutely nothing of interest on that side of the castle, and so everyone tended to erase it completely from their minds. Not Voldemort, though. He really knew Hogwarts and its mysteries well. It was so dark. The stars barely gave any light, hanging there in the sky like stupid, cold witnesses.
It was going to be such a long night, and it would be so dark. Even when the fires broke, they would only make the night darker. Percy knew that if he failed, even if Voldemort died, but the others died too, he just wouldn't be able to read and laugh ever again. For now, he did whatever he could. Crouching on the floor and cursing the stupid night that was so cold and came too early. He wasn't cold because he had put on a couple of good heating charms, but he had had to do it in the first place, which was annoying. Also, it was dark and he didn't dare use Lumos as he carefully laid the cat's hair on the platform's floor. Actual cat's hair. Not a fancy name for a potion's ingredient that turned out to be a funny plant or something cat's hair. Mostly white, a few orange, all laid on the wooden platform and fixed there with a charm. He was putting them in a careful crisscrossing pattern. Why? Well, because Percy here actually cared about his studies. Not that anyone else did, and that included the teachers and, of course, Albus Bloody Dumbledore, who in retrospect seemed like he wanted them to lose, given the kind of DADA teachers he'd hired. Quirrell and Lockhart, for Merlin's sake. Percy blew on his hands to warm his fingers and went back to gluing the cat's hair. Somewhere warm. When I finish, I'm going somewhere warm. The children had an early dinner, and then they lined up on the gate, waiting for the signal to leave. The twins patrolled around them until the last minute, making sure that no one sneaked back. Remus. Remus, they said simultaneously, their voices deep as if weighted with emotion.
Thanks for everything, you know.
Fred waved his hand. Everything. The laughs, the teachings, the encouragement. Even taking care of Harry, because Harry was their sponsor and therefore their favorite person.
We also got you this, added George. Had forgotten about it until we saw Parkinson going crazy over Lavender Brown. Draco's calling ones. We put Sirius, Snape, and myself. If something goes bad, as you take the children.
Remus took the proffered wand. Shorter than any other wand and painted purple and green so there would be no mistaking it.
A good invention, said Remus, because at this point it was better to speak about concrete things rather than goodbyes, and we might not see each other again.
Yeah, well, we don't know if it goes to the charms of Hogwarts, Fred admitted.
They seem to dampen the effect, explained George. Stupid oversight, huh?
No, Remus said firmly. It's a good invention. Both twins blushed slightly.
Anyway, better shake hands now. You know, everything we should say now, you know it, right?
Said George as he clasped Remus's hand tightly.
All the...
Thanks, added Fred as he took his turn.
So, better go now. I see little Frankie hiding in the bushes over there.
The twins left hurriedly to send little Frankie back to the line, even if he was plain visible and it hardly looked urgent. Remus put the wand in his pocket. Sirius had insisted that he wear his long coat and look decently cool during his mission. And then Severus came to open the doors for them. They would walk to Hogsmeade and take a detour before reaching it and go request Mercilius's help once again. In a few hours, they would find themselves miles away from the conflict.
"Come on now, all of you!" yelled Fred. "Out, out, out!"
Remus stayed behind as the children started across the gate.
"I will be very upset if you die,"
he informed Severus now that he felt like he could speak without embarrassing himself.
"I know. I can die with that," Severus said softly. "I won't forgive you."
"No." They hugged and said everything else in that hug and the kiss that followed. How Remus forgave him this act of selfishness, how he would make sure to find Harry and keep protecting him, how Severus in turn promised not to die unless it was unavoidable. It was not a pretty moment, but they had gotten the chance to say goodbye. And that was good. End of chapter 20.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.